Meanwhile, Susan was sitting on the evidence she had been gathering for nearly a year. She had intimations that the L.A. District Attorney was preparing to indict her on a dozen or so felony charges, including unlawful entry into Pacific Bell headquarters and conspiring to commit computer fraud. So she decided it was time to visit Bob Ewan, an investigator in the District Attorney's office, to blow the whistle on her erstwhile buddies. She told Ewan that she had come to him because she was concerned for her nation's security. Kevin knew she had some extremely sensitive information, and Susan was certain that he wanted to get his hands on it. By way of example, Susan told Ewan that she had once spent several days locked in her apartment, and that when she emerged, she told Roscoe and Kevin that she had been downloading and printing out missile firing parameters and maintenance schedules for intercontinental ballistic missiles. She boasted that she knew the schedules of the men who worked in the hole, the men authorized to turn the keys, and that she knew when the maintenance was done and what the backup systems were. Susan claimed that given the right information, one pimply adolescent scrunched into a phone booth with a terminal and a modem, and certainly Roscoe and Kevin, could set off the necessary chain of commands to release hundreds of missiles from their silos and send them hurtling across the globe. She hadn't tested her theory, of course, but she claimed to have developed a method for fooling the computer, leading it to believe that the necessary sequence of actions preceding a first or retaliatory strike had already occurred. The real vulnerability, Susan believed, lay in the nation's communications system. The Pentagon's heavy dependence on the Bell system made it a sitting duck for the likes of Roscoe and Kevin. Susan asked for immunity from prosecution in exchange for doing her civic duty and testifying against Kevin and Roscoe. Ewan knew enough to be leery of the many theories that issued forth from this rara avis. For one thing, he recognized her as the same tall, buck-toothed blonde whose face was familiar to guards at Pacific Bell offices throughout the country. She had been spotted in Pasadena with Mitnick and Rhodes, and in the San Fernando Valley with the one who called himself Roscoe. But Ewan wanted to see Roscoe and Mitnick convicted. He sent her to see the district attorney. As it happened, the district attorney felt exactly the same way. He offered to give her immunity in exchange for her full cooperation. Susan, of course, was fully prepared to take the witness stand and tell her version of everything. When Bob Ewan came into the CMOS case in 1981, he had already been dealing with phone freaks for some time. For years, he kept a collection of confiscated blue boxes and other electronic fraud gear in a box under his desk. Usually there wasn't much to fear from phone freaks. But when he went out to serve a warrant on Mitnick, Ewan wasn't sure what he was dealing with. As Susan Thunder had described the suspect, he was potentially dangerous. Ewan went first to Mitnick's residence to carry out a search. Mitnick wasn't home, but his mother was. Reed, thin, and wearing a skirt that struck Ewan as too short for a woman approaching 40, Shelley Jaffe, who bore some resemblance to Popeye's girl Olive Oil, seemed confused and flustered. As Ewan picked his way through her son's room, Shelley stood at the doorway and popped her gum nervously. She reminded him of a teenager who hadn't outgrown the habit of reading movie magazines and still harbored a dream of becoming a Hollywood discovery. The search wasn't easy. Mitnick appeared to be something of a pack rat. He had apparently saved every scrap of paper and every printout he had ever obtained, and Ewan had to scrutinize all of it. He unearthed printouts filled with telephone company information, computer passwords, and material from one of the computer centers at the University of California at Los Angeles. Shelley became increasingly flustered. She did not, she said, know anything of her son's illegal doings. She assured Ewan that Kevin could not be responsible for the things the police suspected. Kevin, she insisted, was an angelic son. "Then what's this?" Ewan asked, holding up a printout of telephone company information. "I've never seen that before," she responded. "When is the last time you were in your son's room?" "I don't remember." Ewan got the impression that Shelley, who displayed no hints of malice herself, might be intimidated by her son. It was evident that she tried to maintain a decent home, aside from Kevin's cluttered room, which was actually tidy compared with some Ewan had seen. Shelley kept a neat household, but she appeared to have no control over the boy she had raised or the situation at hand. She seldom saw Kevin. Her early hours as a deli waitress rarely coincided with her son's more nocturnal schedule. Clearly, she knew nothing about computers and had no desire to try to learn anything about them. It was Ewan's hunch that even telephones might overwhelm her. Among all the evidence Ewan gathered in Kevin's bedroom, he found nothing linking the suspect to the Cosmos break-in. There were no manuals, directories, or other signs that Kevin had been there. Still, on the strength of the guard's identification of Mitnick, Ewan had obtained an arrest warrant. Although the Mitnick family hadn't been particularly observant Jews, Kevin often went after school to the Stephen Wise Temple in the private community of Bel Air, where he worked part-time. Ewan drove to the synagogue with three other officers. The four men divided into two cars and waited in the parking lot for Mitnick to show up. When Mitnick began to pull into the lot, he apparently saw the men sitting in their unmarked cars because he hesitated, then drove by. As soon as he took off, the police peeled after him, sirens ablare. Mitnick's car accelerated. Just as Mitnick pulled onto the 405 freeway headed north, his pursuers overtook him and forced him onto the shoulder. At first, Ewan wasn't sure what he was up against. The suspect was very large, at least 200 pounds, and possibly armed. Ewan feared Kevin and his buddies might have modified the Cosmos computers and planted a logic bomb, a hidden computer program designed to destroy data at a given time. This made Ewan worry that he might even have a terrorist on his hands, so they handled him as roughly as they would a murder suspect. Guns drawn, they pushed him onto the hood of his car and handcuffed his hands behind his back. It wasn't until the officers felt not muscle under his shirt, but soft and pliable flab, that they realized this young man was no physical threat and loosened their grip. Mitnick complained that he had to go to the bathroom immediately. Then he began to cry. "You scared me. I thought I was going to die." "Why did you think you were going to die?" Ewan asked. "I thought they were after me." "Who?" asked Ewan, bewildered. "You know, there are a lot of people that don't like me." Kevin didn't mention it to Ewan, but a few months earlier he had been hunted down by an irate ham operator who was fed up with Kevin's hijinks. Ewan told Kevin that he was sorry to hear that people didn't like him. He was just doing his job, he said, and would have to take the teenager to jail in handcuffs. In the car, Kevin began to talk. He admitted to knowing Roscoe and Susan and Steve Rhodes. Then, as if he suddenly realized he was talking to an officer, he stopped talking. When Ewan asked him if he had put a logic bomb in the phone company computers, Kevin looked as if he might start to cry again. No, he insisted, he would never do anything to hurt a computer. Recovering the Cosmos manuals proved more difficult than finding the suspects. Once Kevin had been taken into custody and his mother and grandmother had hired a lawyer for him, Ewan began to press the lawyer for the missing manuals. Ewan was particularly worried that the manuals would be copied and distributed throughout the freaking community. He shuddered at the possibility. With passwords and dial-up numbers, freaks could shut down much of the phone service in the greater Los Angeles area. Kevin's attorney insisted that Kevin didn't have them, but that he might know where to find them. A few days later, the lawyer delivered all of the stolen manuals. The prosecutor decided to fold the cases against Kevin and Roscoe together. Both were charged with burglary and grand theft, and with conspiring to commit computer fraud, felonies under California law. The charges would be for the U.S. leasing incident, already more than a year old, and the Cosmos break-in. U.S. Leasing's John Whipple, who had long since dismissed the entire incident as a bad dream, was surprised to hear that the vandals who had crippled and defiled his company's computers had been apprehended and charged with having maliciously accessed, altered, deleted, damaged, and destroyed the U.S. leasing system. Mark Ross was charged with burglary and conspiring to commit computer fraud in connection with the Cosmos break-in. After Roscoe was arrested, his mother gave him a choice. He could either use her money to hire a lawyer, an old friend from Argentina who knew nothing about computers or computer crime, or draw on his own meager resources and hire whomever he pleased. Although he had found a good criminal lawyer who had experience in cases such as his and would charge less than his mother's friend, Roscoe could do nothing to persuade her to pay. He ended up with the computer-illiterate Argentine. While the defendants were out on bail and the prosecution was preparing its case, Ewan decided it might be a good idea to eavesdrop on one of Shakey's meetings. So one night before the trial, Ewan, the juvenile prosecutor, and Pacific Bell and GTE investigators dressed in the most casual clothing their closets could produce and convened at the Hollywood Shakey's. They seated themselves at a table about 30 feet away from the group. Neither Roscoe nor Mitnick was in attendance. Rhodes was also absent. Instead, seated at the freak's table, the center of attention, was Susan. The group of law enforcers sat in disbelief as their star witness took over the meeting, trading phone information with the others, oblivious to the presence of the men she was working for. When she and another freak got up to leave, Ewan followed her to the parking lot and watched as she retrieved a printout from the other freak's car. "Susan," Ewan called to her as she was returning to the restaurant, "what do you think you're doing?" It took Susan a few seconds to focus on Ewan. Indulging her vanity, she seldom wore her glasses. When she recognized Ewan, she grew defensive. "Hey, I thought I could get some stuff you guys could use." Ewan looked at her sternly. "Okay," she conceded. "So, I still like to do this stuff."